Good morning to you and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. I've had the privilege of being an instructor at the University of Arizona for the last 33 years in the Eller College and the Social and Behavior Sciences College. And I said this last Friday, but I'm just going to say it again. I got to go to, with Sixto Molina and Danya Clough, we went to the rooftop of the playground, and I got the outstanding faculty member of the Eller College for 2024. So I was really proud of that. And thank you for coming, Sixto Molina.
My pleasure. And Congratulations again.
Well, thank you. That was kind of nice. The nice thing about that is an award that is generated by the students. And so the students vote who their favorite or their popular. I gave them all gift cards before they voted. Well, it's an honor after 33 years to be noted like that again. That's been great. Well, Friday is our success stories for businesses, and Mondays we talk about wonder at the University of Arizona. On Tuesdays, Ted talks a little bit about government and engagement, and Grant talks about restaurants and politics a little bit, and Tom talks about things that have to do with attractions and visitors. But on Mondays here, we talk about wonder, the good things that are going on at the University of Arizona. In our second segment, we're going to be talking to Dr. Shubin Zhang, who has a fascinating way of predicting hurricanes. And this is a good example of why Jumpin' Tucson is kind of unique, in that we're talking about things that are helpful to the community, all the good stuff that's happening at the University of Arizona. But it seems sometimes that the headlines are grabbed by the things that are a challenge. Obviously in the last couple of weeks across the country, there's been quite a bit of notice to campuses where students are expressing their voice and talking about international issues and so forth. And we've had a little bit of that going on at the University of Arizona. Today, Sixto, let's talk first about your law enforcement training, because I want to talk to you a little bit about what it's like to confront that situation where there's a lot of people and they have a lot of emotions going on. But let's talk first about your own personal journey of becoming a police officer and then a police chief, and your years of working in the security side of things.
Well, to start with, when I was a kid, the only contact I had with cops was through TV, watching Dragnet and Sergeant Joe Friday.
As your license plate on your truck is a testament to that, right?
Yes, it's LAPD 714, and it's a tribute to Sergeant Joe Friday, because I did learn a lot from him. And the LAPD actually changed how they did things based on a lot of the things that he did on his show. But I went to high school at Pueblo High School, and while I was there, I was part of the ADECA program, Distributive Education Clubs of America. And as part of the program, I was working I got a job at Sacani's department store, working in retail, selling shoes and men's clothing. And the store hired off-duty cops, and that was my first real contact with real cops. And we got to talking, and I developed an interest in police work. And then one day, we had two stores at the Southgate Shopping Center, and we had to check on both stores. Well, we had an alarm at the main store, and the alarm went off at the children's shop. And so me and the officer, Detective Steve Zimmerman, walked to the children's shop to see what was going on, what the alarm was about. We thought, okay, maybe it's a shoplifter or somebody. No, we walked into an armed robbery, two guys with guns holding up the place. And Steve Zimmerman tells me, grab the guy. And so I grabbed one of the robbers, who had a paper bag over his hand and he had a gun. And because I grabbed him, he got scared and ran. And the other robber also ran, and then there was an exchange of gunfire between Steve and the robbers. And of course, my adrenaline shot sky high. From that point on, I was hooked. I said, I got to get into police work. So I was 18 at the time. And when I turned 19, I got a job with the South Tucson Police Department as a dispatcher for police and fire. You had to be 21 to be a cop, but I wasn't old enough, but I could dispatch. So I did that for about a year and a half, and when I turned 21, I applied with the Tucson Police Department and got the job at TPD in 1972, and I was there till 1997. During that time, I had a variety of assignments, patrol sergeant, detective, detective sergeant, burglary sergeant, child sexual abuse sergeant. I was one of the supervisors, sergeant of the Mobile Field Force, which is a fancy name for the riot squad. Mm-hmm. So I've been all over the place. In 97, there was an opening for a police chief at the South Tucson Police Department. Several Tucson police officers had retired to be police chiefs at the Tucson Police Department. And so I thought, okay, you know, I can do this. So I applied and I got the job. The mayor and council unanimously approved me, and I was there for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the amazing things about is the relationships that you have. I tease all the time that when we would go to events when I was running for mayor and you'd be with me, they'd say, "Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ed Ackerley, candidate for mayor, and Sixto Molina, his campaign chair," and everybody would come running over to see you. They weren't coming to see me. They were coming to see Sixto. But that leads me to when we would go to, like, say, football games and stuff, and there would be all of the officers from UAPD and TPD and the sheriff's office, how it took us 45 minutes to get into the stadium because you're stopping and talking to one guy after another that you've encountered over those years of your years as a police officer and a police chief. So you know a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, it's great to be able to talk to a lot of people. Unfortunately, many of them are starting to die off now.
Right, yeah. Well, they got to have more therapy out on the on the golf course like you're going to have tomorrow playing golf. Hey, when we come back after the break, what I want to talk about is how the University of Arizona, but in general, how campuses across the country can approach collections of students who want to have their voice heard one way or another, and how law enforcement has to step in at certain times and how the best way to do that is. And we'll talk a little bit about what's happened here briefly on the U of A campus. But as President Robbins said when he first got appointed as the president, his number one responsibility is to keep the students safe. So I want to talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. We're talking with my campaign chair for when I ran for mayor, Sixto Molina, a retired police officer and police chief who has a wealth of knowledge in security and police operations. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what's going on across the country and take Sixto's perspective on that. We'll be back in just a few minutes on Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. I'm an instructor, a career faculty member at the University of Arizona. I've been at the Yeller College for 33 years. This session is Wonder, the good things that happen. We talk on Monday in Jump in Tucson about the good things that are happening at the University of Arizona. And with me today is my good friend and campaign chair when I ran for mayor, Sixto Molina, who is a retired police officer, but more importantly, made the decisions at the top as a police chief. And so, Sixto, you know, across the country, we've had this this situation where campuses are getting tent cities and students who are voicing their concerns about you know, an international issue regarding Israel and Gaza and the situation there. And as a police chief and as a law enforcement guy for so many years, you know, you have to look at the response that we've seen on some campuses across the country and the use of force and the way that some have approached it. Or you can look at the way the University of Arizona approached the situation here last week, and you know, things may crop up during graduation and so forth. But the president and the Steve Patterson, the vice president of public safety, and Chris Olson, the new police chief at UAPD, kind of have addressed this in a really positive way and have done a good job of managing this. So I just, your reflection on what a police chief can do and what is the best way to handle these very volatile situations when emotions run high like this.
Well, you know, as we know, people have a right to demonstrate peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when they cross a line that the problems begin to start. So it's important to have communication beforehand with the organizers of the protest so that they know what the rules of engagement are and so that the police know what their thoughts are. The police have to remain neutral throughout the situation. You can't take sides. So you just have to enforce and apply the law as best as you can. And I'll give you an example. When I was with the Tucson Police Department, I was a supervisor of the mobile field force, of one of the squads of the mobile field force. The other supervisor was Sergeant Jean Gonzalez. And we got called out to the Doubletree Hotel when Pat Buchanan was running for president several years ago. And outside the hotel, there was a group of demonstrators. And they were chanting and doing all kinds of things, the things that demonstrators do. It was a peaceful demonstration, but things started getting a little hairy. And what you have to do, you have to be very sensitive to what's going on, because you can feel when violence is about to erupt or things are going to get out of hand. And usually what happens, even though it's not planned, somebody does something and then the mob mentality kicks in and everybody follows suit. It happens not only with protesters, it can happen with police officers that are trying to stop the protesters. One cop gets out of control and the others have to jump in and help. So you have to be very sensitive to that mob mentality. So in this case, the protesters were chanting and you could feel things were going on. The commander said, look, if they cross this line, if the protesters cross this line, you know, we're going to have to deploy the gas.
Mm-hmm.
So we were ready to deploy the gas. So the protesters were moving closer and closer to the line. And just before we deployed the gas, Sergeant Jean Gonzalez says, hey, wait, time out, to the commander. He says, can we talk to the leader of the protest group? And the commander said, yeah, go ahead. So Sergeant Gonzalez and I approached the protesters, and the leader of the group was Isabel Garcia, who was a childhood friend of ours,
mm-hmm.
because her dad was president of the Little League that we played in.
Right.
So she would sell snow cones to generate money for the league while we played baseball. And so we knew Isabel. We went to school with her. And we approached Isabel and said, hey, Isabel, here's the rules. You can't cross this line. As long as you don't cross this line, we're not going to stop you. And she says, oh, okay, we can do that. So they went about their business, and we stayed around, and nothing ever happened. But that was very important, to have communication with the leader of the group so that everybody knows what the rules of engagement are. Now, if they cross a line, if they get violent, start violence or vandalism, now that changes the rules. But to your point, I think communication is very important, that both sides know what the other side is thinking.
And we have to hand it to the administration for being very articulate about what the responsibilities were, what they're going to protect their right to speech. But once you cross the line and begin violence or vandalism or hate speech, then we're going to step in, and they are clearly articulated to them over and over again,
yes,
here's what you can and can't do. And we will protect you for your right to protest and to demonstrate, but we're also going to make sure that you or nobody else does anything that's unlawful or breaks up the institution in such a way that you can't have graduation or you can't have classes because things are going on. And so they handled it in a very professional way. Kudos to Steve Patterson and to Chris Olson, who's the police chief, for being able to moderate the situation. But what they did was communicate, and they communicated clearly, and the president communicated his what the lines were.
And that is so important, is communication.
And as we move forward through the summer and so forth, of course, it's in Tucson, it's a little different because it would be a little bit hotter than some of the other campuses. But if students go away for different things, you don't know what the future brings, and you don't know what's going to be happening, obviously, in the political world over in Israel and Gaza and so forth. So you don't know whether ceasefires or whatever is going to be happening, if that will mitigate this. But we got a couple conventions coming up to select presidential candidates. And so the right to protest is a valued thing in our country, and right to free speech and be able to say what you want to say, as long as it doesn't cross over to hate speech and doesn't cross over to victimizing certain groups. Say what you want to say and say it loudly, and we'll protect that right.
Exactly. But like I said, even though the organizers don't intend to have any violence or vandalism, all you need is one or two people to get out of hand, and then the mob mentality kicks in.
And that's where it's the great thing. All you have to do is go to a U of A football game and see the cooperation between UAPD, the Sheriff's Office, TPD, Marana, Oro Valley Police, Sarita Police Force. You just see the great cooperation that our municipal law enforcement agencies have with one another. And so when Steve or Chris has to call in some reinforcements from TPD or whatever, they work together very closely and have a great communication between them as well.
Right, and it goes beyond that, because there's intergovernmental agreements between the cities and the towns to help each other in these type of situations.
Right.
And that authorizes the law enforcement agencies to work together.
And this is where training is so important for law enforcement, that they know exactly what they should be doing. And if someone hurls a water bottle at you because they're frustrated or whatever, don't take that personally, and don't let your emotions get out of control. Let's do what we came here to do, which is to protect the people that are speaking, but also make sure that there's not vandalism or things that veer over into that unlawful behavior. That is, you know, we're gonna do what we have to do to protect the institution.
Exactly. Like I said, don't cross the line, because there is a line there, and that line is criminal activity. Vandalism, assaults, and those kind of things.
I just have to, again, hand it to Steve Patterson and the president. They have done an excellent job of implementing the 31 initiatives for campus safety that came out of the report. And plus, they've added some other ones. Even in my own building, the Eller College, the McClelland Hall, they've replaced the big, giant glass doors with panic bars. And they've done everything that the consultants said that we needed to do to make the and then it's a work in progress, because some of these will take a little bit longer. But every door on campus basically is being refitted, and you know, that's millions of dollars to do all the doors. But and then they have this system in all the classrooms where we are notified if something is going on. And so you know, as President Robbins said, public safety and the safety of the students that are going to school there, and equally important, the staff and faculty and the community that come on campus every day, how important it is for them to have a professional approach to that, and have that be the number one thing that they focus on. So we appreciate your good knowledge of this subject, and we hope that as we move into the summertime and graduation in a couple days, and then moving into the summer, that it'll be peaceful here in Tucson, and that the same record of nonviolence will continue.
Yeah, hopefully the heat will do some good.
Yeah, that's one time when you're glad that maybe there's a 115 degree weather out there. It's not so fun to camp outside when it's 115 degrees. Well, coming up in the next segment, we're going to have Dr. Shubin Zeng talk about predicting hurricanes. What a fascinating story he has, and it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say about predicting hurricanes. Sixto, thank you for being here talking about campus safety, how important it is, especially at the University of Arizona. So many wonderful things happening at the U of A, and one of them is that we're keeping students and faculty and staff safe. So thank you for your perspective on that.
Thank you.
You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk. And coming up in just after the break, we'll have Dr. Shubin Zeng from the College of Science. He'll talk about predicting hurricanes in the Atlantic for the season coming up starting June 1st. So we'll take a break now. We'll be back in just a minute on Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. Coming up tomorrow, General Ted Maxwell will be the host of Jump in Tucson's Engagement Hour. On Wednesday, Grant Kruger hosts, and Thursday, Tom Moulton talks about visitor attractions. I return this coming Friday with business success stories. You know, Jump in Tucson continues with the Wonder Series, which is about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. Our guest for this segment is Dr. Shubin Zeng. He's a professor in the university's Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences and the director of the Climate Dynamics and Hydrometeorology Center at the University of Arizona. Good morning, Dr. Zeng.
Good morning.
Before we get started and talk about your hurricane predictions, let's talk a little bit about how you came to the University of Arizona and a little bit about your background as a scientist and a meteorologist.
Sure. I moved to Tucson 30 years ago. This Wow. is exactly the 30th year. I thought I would be here for a couple of years, but before I realized it, now 30 years have passed, and my two children grew up here. Now they finish their degrees, and they are working.
Great. Well, you know, you're a meteorologist, so you love the weather in Tucson. So that's kind of one of the reasons people stay here is the weather.
Well, that's true. Plus, right. We can work on weather and climate anywhere in the world from our beloved Tucson.
Right. That's fantastic. So what is the genesis of Climate Dynamics and Hydrometeorology Center, and how did that get started? And you've been making predictions for 10 years, but how did that all get started in the college?
More than 10 years ago, our Dean of College of Science, Joaquin Ruiz, asked me, hey, say, Shubin, you should bring people together to do big things. And I would support you. The dean would support me to set up a new research center. And I thought that's a great idea. And I spent a year essentially talk with professors across five different colleges and then bring people together, set up the center. It is a virtual center. That means we do not have secretary, do not have dedicated offices, because I just want to focus on big things. For smaller things, individual professors can do on their own.
And you're relying on data that comes to you from the National Weather Service, from the other places, the federal government, Europe, and other places that are predicting weather. And you're bringing that data all together and analyzing it and making your predictions from that information, correct?
That's right.
And what kind of data are you looking at? Historical data over many years, or when you're making a prediction for a given year, what kind of data are you looking at, and what is the team compiling in order to come out with the predictions that you'll come out for a specific year?
You know, you are really asking really the right questions without coordinating. This is pretty cool. One unique aspect of our efforts is that every year we polish and refine our methods using historical data, including the immediate past year. That's how we can improve, hopefully, year after year. And we use all data available, connected by volunteers, our citizens, and by government agencies in the US and internationally. And then the predictions from national centers and international centers. We did our homework looking at all those data, and in the end, used machine learning to bring them together for our prediction.
So you started this process before AI, you know, became the topic of conversation amongst people, and certainly you're using computers to help you understand the data that you're interpreting. But is AI involved in the now or in the future to help predict these weather phenomena? And are you using
Are you developing anything that makes this a little easier for you to compile the data and the predictions?
You know, that's another great question. At the beginning, we did not talk about AI. The term was not there yet. And today, the beauty is we realize some of the good old simple methods still works out very well. Well, for some of the other things, machine learning is working out better, and we are combining them whenever one method works out best, we use it rather than just saying we use the fancier machine learning method.
You know, weather by its very the nature and by definition is unpredictable. You just never really know. You know, the old joke is the weather person will get on and say it's going to be light today and dark tonight, but that's really all we know. We don't know. We don't know what the actual weather is going to be like. And they're pretty accurate, you know, 10 to 12, 15 days out, a local weathercaster can tell you what things are going to be like. But when you make your predictions and so forth, you really are making a prediction, but it's not necessarily, it may not come out the way that you've predicted just because of the variance that happens in weather phenomena, correct?
Yeah. So by the way, my PhD dissertation was on chaos theory and its applications about the predictability. So that's one aspect. Another aspect is we have our own joke. And I hope I'm not offending professors in the business school. Our joke is we meteorologists are doing a much better job in prediction than economists. But right. They get much better paid than we do get. Okay, that's our.
I love that. I love that. So we're gonna when we come back, we'll talk about your hurricane predictions. But do you and your team predict other weather activity, such as like say in Tucson, Southern Arizona, the monsoon season, or tornadoes through the Midwest, or weather phenomena out over the oceans? Are you predicting, or are you limiting yourself to just the hurricane season, or are you trying to provide a model that's predicting weather across the globe?
You know, that's really a great question. For science, prediction is the most important test of the understanding theory and hypothesis. That's why personally, I love prediction. We are trying to predict all different things, but we say nothing. We just shut up if we do not show some good skills. And for the actual prediction besides hurricanes, we publish another paper for the prediction of mesoscale convective systems. That's the stuff you would have over central US, for example, causing substantial storms and tornadoes. That's the stuff we are predicting not every day, and we are actually pushing for a new satellite mission to try to help us predict those organized convection. So besides the mesoscale convective systems generating tornadoes, for example, also hurricanes are organized convection. Monsoon is driven by organized convection and atmospheric river affecting California, really more than Tucson. Are also driven by organized convection. Again, we are planning a potential satellite mission to do the prediction and understanding of that organized convection.
So by looking at that data, you can make a prediction, if you will, about whether we're going to have a strong monsoon season in the Southwest or whether it will be light, based similar to what you're going to be doing, telling us about hurricanes. If you look at that organized system, then you can kind of make some predictions from that.
Oh, well, that's for different time scale, because the prediction, right. You can do the seasonal prediction. Keep in mind, we are doing that most of the time, just like you said, the prediction scale is not good.
Right, right.
Well, you know, sometimes a little bit scared. Our April prediction of hurricane activities, essentially 6 months ahead of time, has been pretty good. But I know someday we are going to mess up because this is the nature of
it's
predicting
nature.
Future.
Predicting nature is tough. Well, when we come back, we'll take a little break and we'll discuss your predictions for an active hurricane season coming up starting June 1st. And you're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk station. We'll be right back after a few commercials from our great sponsors. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. We're talking to Dr. Shubin Zhang, a professor in the university's Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences out of the College of Science and director of the Climate Dynamics and Hydrometeorology Center at the University of Arizona. Welcome back, Dr. Zhang.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A recent article in UA News says brace for a very active hurricane season this year, and Arizona published that and said, look out, forecasters, here comes a pretty brisk hurricane season. So in 2023, the record was 20 named storms and 3 hurricanes that you predicted. And tell us a little bit about the region that you're looking at from the Gulf Coast forward. What's the geographic region that you're looking at in terms of hurricane prediction for the United States?
It's the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. So essentially the Gulf coasts, Florida and the East coasts would be affected by hurricane activities over the Atlantic basin.
By definition, then a hurricane starts in the warmer climates down south, closer to the equator, and they come up through the Gulf and up through the Atlantic side of the country. And so that's a typical progression of from south to north is how hurricanes travel, correct?
That's right.
And is that because of the heat that's being generated in the warmer parts of the ocean? And then as it moves through those systems that you talked about, it begins to develop into stronger winds, and that's where the hurricane force comes in?
That's correct. And the interesting fact is, we need the warm water over the tropics, but we do not want to go to equator because essentially there are no hurricanes there because you need the rotation.
I see.
There's a so-called Coriolis force due to Earth's rotation.
Right. And that's mostly north of the equator out in the islands and so forth, and it's coming through and then coming up through the Gulf sometimes, or even coming straight through to the Atlantic side and then typically going up the coast, correct? That comes inland for a little ways, but it's typically a coastal trajectory, correct?
Well, once a hurricane makes a landfall, the land surface, including our urban areas, will provide too much friction that will help dissipate the strength of hurricanes, and also the energy source for hurricanes are from the ocean surface. Right. Over land, you cut off the source, and hence hurricane would become weaker. But doesn't mean it's not powerful. It could remain powerful all the way to northeast or New England area.
Mm-hmm. And would those then go down from a hurricane to maybe more of a tropical storm at that point?
Once they
get below 74 miles an hour, they're kind of classified as a strong storm, not anymore as a hurricane, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So in 2023, there were 20 named storms and 3 hurricanes, and you've made a prediction for 2024. So what is your prediction? What are you thinking your data shows, and what do you think is going to be the structure of the hurricane season in 2024?
You know, one thing I want to emphasize for named storms last year, the reality was 20. And you know our prediction in April, what's our number? Do you want to guess?
15.
19.
Okay. So you're right there.
That's 6 months ahead of time. We were predicting 19 named storms in the end, 20 last year.
That's a pretty good record. Good record.
Okay, you know, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
This is a real prediction, not hindcast.
Right.
And this year, we are predicting 21 named storms and 11 hurricanes.
Keep
in mind, the average hurricane for a year would be 7. And then for major hurricanes, that means category 3, 4, and 5, we are predicting 5 major hurricanes. Those are the most powerful hurricanes, have substantial impacts if they make a landfall.
And that's two more than or three major hurricanes last season, and so it's uptick of and part of this, the part of the description of this is La Nina and the effects of the Pacific Ocean on the Atlantic Ocean. Can you tell us the difference between El Nino weather phenomena and the La Nina weather phenomena that is part of the fuel for this type of a season?
Yeah. Again, we talk about hurricanes over the Atlantic Ocean, but the global atmosphere is interconnected. El Nino is about the warming of ocean surface temperature over the eastern Pacific. And if we have El Nino like last year, then that would affect the wind and its variation with the height over the Atlantic Ocean. And the overall effect is wind will change most strongly with the height, and that does not help the formation and strengthening of hurricanes. That's why last year we did not see as many more major hurricanes as we expected.
Yeah, so we're in for a pretty significant hurricane season. How fast are winds in a major hurricane? If you look at the five that you're predicting, what is the wind speed going to be for those major hurricanes?
The starting minimum wind would be 111 miles per hour. Don't drive at that speed, otherwise you're going to get some real trouble from cops.
Right. That's a pretty significant, and then it goes tops out, and that if you're a hurricane five, it's up in the 150 miles per hour range or somewhere. It tops out at that.
That's right.
What is the highest recorded hurricane speed? Is it about 150 miles an hour?
Or more than that.
More than that.
Yeah. And keep in mind, it's not just a hurricane wind over the coastal region. There are also sea level rise. So sea level is increasing. If it's unfortunate that the hurricanes are in combination with other factors, we could have very substantial storm surge that would flood in the coastal area.
And that's a major concern for municipalities along the coast, but also individual property owners who own property along the coast. When the sea level rises in a hurricane, there's rain, there's wind, but there's also that sea level rise, which causes flooding and damage to property and to beaches and everything. So the predictions that you're making are really important for municipalities and towns along the coast, and for property owners who might have the opportunity to purchase something along the coast. They better watch out. It's going to be a pretty strong season, huh?
Exactly. What I'm thinking about, for most of us average Joes, houses are our major investments, and you have to calculate the risks if you want to buy a beautiful house right on beach.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what an interesting subject that you have of, and what a great record. You've been doing this since 2010. So you have, the 2010, right, is when it started?
For the hurricane, we started about 10 years ago.
2014, yeah.
Yeah, for the center, we started the center a few years earlier, and we are doing many other things.
Right. So you have a 10-year record, and you're pretty darn accurate. You've been able to predict with pretty good accuracy how many hurricanes and the force and the type. So that's great. That's really good science that you're doing at the University of Arizona. That's part of our Wonder program. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. This is Dr. Shubin Zhang, who is a professor in the university's Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences, who is a predictor of hurricanes and the hurricane season. So thank you, Dr. Zhang. Really appreciate you being with us today on Jump in Tucson.
You are welcome.
This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson on the Friday show, you can share your success story. Go to jumpintucson.com and let us know a little bit about you. Who knows? Maybe you'll be interviewed live on the air. This is Tucson's only live local news talk station, KVOI, 1030 AM, The Voice. Thanks for listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll see you again on Friday.